Welcome to Haldane's Law Matters. Thank you. Today, it's a great pleasure to welcome Adrian Hawkes, not only as a friend, but as a lawyer, and a very specific lawyer to Hong Kong, actually. He's become the sort of king of the restaurant and bar industries here, because he's an expert in every single aspect of that sort of industry, and in particular, licensing. But that's only the tip of the iceberg, because Adrian goes back an awful long way. Adrian, welcome. And shall we start in 1976? Do you remember what was going on in your life then?
Oh, crikey. Well, firstly, thanks for the king elevation. Better than being the queen, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we can discuss that.
Yes, well, 1976, landed in Hong Kong as a teenage police inspector. Fresh off the plane, after a stop in India, because you didn't get that far in one go. And a huge adventure for a young guy brought up in the Midlands in a military family, which I think maybe swayed getting the job to being one of the youngest police inspectors in the force at that time. So, yeah, a big leap.
A big leap indeed. And did you interview for the police in England and then come out, or was it a flyer?
No. You did go down to, I think it was Grafton Street, to the sort of Hong Kong liaison office where you were given a panel interview. They paid for you to go down to London to be interviewed. And then literally a few weeks later, there was a letter saying, yep, you're in, pack your bags, get on your way to Hong Kong. And that was it.
And so, that's about half a century ago, roughly speaking.
It won't be that far off yet.
Goodness. Yep. Yeah,
and I remember going to my father and saying, I've got this job in Hong Kong. It's a long way away.
And he said, where's that?
No, he knew where Hong Kong was because we'd been in Singapore when I was a child.
Ah.
So he said, oh, that's good. That's 8,000 miles away, yes. And I went, yeah, about that. He said, yeah, you and I get on very well at a distance. And that's a good distance. So
that was the style of parenting in the 1970s.
It was certainly my father's style.
Yeah, it's quite a good style. So when you arrived in Hong Kong, what was your first impression?
I think for Hong Kong itself, we didn't get much of a first impression except to be on the very, very first night of arrival. But then it was into pretty much 8 months of solid training out of Wong Chuk Hang. You only got a sort of day a week off, and then there was revision and things. So I don't think the impressions of Hong Kong started to form until after training, when you got released onto the streets, as it were.
It was 8 months of training.
Yep, 8 months. Initial first two left you wondering whether or not you were joining a police force, because in fact, we spent most of the time in a language lab, a bit like we are now with headphones on and listening to and parroting Cantonese. And then the rest of the time, such that there was spent marching and doing physical training. And
Do you speak Cantonese now?
And now, yes. Very much so. Pretty well,
I think.
I'd say pretty good, yeah.
Modesty forbids more than that.
I can get around, I can order food, I can pretty much do everything I need to do. But just to build on the days, though, the actual law, policing, learning how to lead and all that didn't really kick in until after about 2 months.
Right.
And then once we'd got through the language and some basics, we then started proper training.
And would they let you onto the streets at that stage?
No. No, you got one attachment. I think I did mine to Kowloon City. So that got me into the walled city at that time. That was fun. But no, you only got a short attachment to a district for a couple of weeks.
You didn't arrest anybody?
Certainly not during training.
No.
Later, yes.
Right.
But not then.
I've only been a policeman in Hong Kong, but were you pretty impressed with the way in which the training went and the degree of professionalism, or did it leave you cold?
I think it's a bit like joining the French Foreign Legion. It was tough. Everybody who joined was pretty much a unique character, and many different ones from all over the place. We had Australians, South Africans, the New Zealanders, Brits, and they'd come from the military, from the police forces, from all sorts, all walks. But it was pretty tough, I would say. For an 18-year-old, it was a bit of a shock.
Now, I think I'm right in saying that when all that training was over, you elected to have a post right out on the border.
Yeah. You got a chance to apply for which district you'd fancy. And of course, most people wanted the bright lights, Tsim Sha Tsui, the nightclubs, the depths of Mong Kok and Sham Shui Po, perhaps. But I fancied the new territories, yeah. So I actually ticked that box and asked to get out into the countryside.
Where were you stationed? Do you remember?
First police station and first role that most people got was what they called a subunit commander. That gave you one shift a day, so 8 hours of 24. And my first one was Yuen Long. So I got to be in essence, in control of the streets of Yuen Long for 8 hours a day, 6 days a week.
And needless to say, Yuen Long was nothing like it is today.
It was far more of a market town hub than the city it is today. Villagers bringing in their vegetables to sell in the mornings, laying them out.
Chickens and things.
Everything was all over the street markets. The physical large-scale markets hadn't really been constructed. So Yuen Long was a market town, a big one, of course. But
And fun days?
Oh, it was all fun. All the two tours I did, nearly 6 years, almost all of it was fun. I've got to say, there weren't many horrible moments, that's for sure. Most of it was good fun.
So you left in 1984?
Around that time, yeah, around 83, 84.
And what took you out of it?
Well, basically, as I decided to leave school at 18, I'd watched people with degrees, been to university and things, and thought, well, if I don't get a degree, I might get left behind some way in career terms. So that was one motivation. The second was I took a look at the Hong Kong police and the way it was going. Sorry, Royal Hong Kong Police back then. Mm-hmm. And there was a sort of tilt towards localization creeping in. And I actually...
As early as 1980, early
1980s. Early 80s, yeah. And that was something that led me to believe that it was possible that I'd never actually be able to get to be Commissioner of Police. Merit apart, right?
You didn't lack ambition then?
I don't know if it was ever the right job for me anyway, to be honest. I don't think I would have been the right man for the job.
So you decided that that was enough of the police force. And for a while, I suppose, it was enough of Hong Kong, wasn't it? Because you returned to England.
I was lucky. I could get into a program at the University of Hull. So they had a great program for mature entrants who didn't quite make the A-level standards they wanted. So there were six of us on that cohort, a couple of UK police officers, nurse, a banker, the trade union rep, and myself. And I got a great slot to study law. It was a super faculty, very, very left-leaning, very Marxist. It's a bit of a shock having come from a colonial police force for 6 years.
Did you like the town of Hull?
Oh, it was great. The people,
really?
People were fantastic.
Well, Yorkshire people. Yeah.
It was great. Everybody was incredibly friendly. Yeah. I mean, it was... Undoubtedly, it's a different city now. I haven't been back for years, but yeah, it was a great place.
Okay, so you went and studied...
Law. The reason for studying law is a bit off-piste because I guess I was kind of pragmatic and thought, well, if I'm going to spend 3 years of my life studying something, it may as well be something I can use later.
Yeah.
Whether that was the right decision or not, I don't know. Maybe it should have been fine art or photography or something more fun, but for better or for worse... Law is what it was.
Law could be fun.
It was a tough course initially because I was too forensic. I didn't realise that the questioning and the whole process wasn't about getting the right answers, but the process, which is exactly the opposite of all the police exams, which had right and wrong answers.
Yeah.
But eventually I figured out what they wanted from me and got through it. Yes, it was good.
So at that point you thought, great, I'm going to be a solicitor.
Not quite. I didn't really have a view as to what I was going to do at the end of the degree. Mm. Merely getting on the course was hard enough. The idea of becoming a barrister became an idea, became a pathway that looked attractive for various reasons. It didn't turn out that I felt that was the right thing for me either. So,
just pausing there, did you think you were going to become a lawyer after your degree in England, or did you always think of coming back to Hong Kong?
Initially, I thought of doing it in England.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't really tracked that I would then go onwards to have a legal career in Hong Kong, no. The solicitor's route was a difficult one. I was already a bit older, remember. So then by then I would have been plus six in Hong Kong, another 9 years out of school. And the number of law firms taking on trainees who were now half a dozen years older than expected was limited, and the options were not so good anyway.
Yeah.
In-house roles, again, they weren't too plentiful. So the bar looked like it, becoming a barrister looked like it was the best route in England at that.
But I don't think you went that route, did you?
Nope. That one didn't pan out particularly well.
So having slept on it, you decided to...
Having reviewed all the options, seen what the bar offered, seen the challenges of that. I was then already a father. I had a one-year-old son.
Okay.
I was married. Yeah. And I thought maybe something more entrepreneurial and fun and business-like would be better. So that was the next step.
What did you choose for business?
I actually stumbled across 3D imaging and commercial holograms, which at that time hadn't found their way onto credit cards, hadn't found their way into the normal world, and thought, well, that's innovative. That's an interesting product and material. I found out nobody was doing it in Hong Kong. So I thought, well, let's launch Hong Kong's first hologram company.
And that was a raging success.
Actually, it was a raging failure. We had the wrong product at the wrong time, at the wrong price, in a place that didn't even understand what we were selling, because the word hologram actually was unknown, even in English, let alone Cantonese.
Right.
So if you imagine walking up to somebody and saying, I sell something, but the word you're saying makes no sense to them whatsoever. Oh, boy.
Hiding to nothing, as they say.
Yes. So it was time. It took a couple of years for the market to come to us and for it to evolve. And then it became very profitable. It was a darn good business, but not for the first couple of years.
Now, let's see if we can get you into the law.
Go for it.
Okay. So you're in
Hong Kong. Be careful.
You're in Hong Kong. You'd done this little business venture. It wasn't going well. You decided then, perhaps?
No, it was going well, actually. No. And, of course, any business that's going well needs a lawyer. So I had a few legal bumps, and I wasn't a lawyer, wasn't a qualified one, so I decided to find one. And then, as you know this backstory, I then locked onto Jeff Booth in your firm. He was recommended to me, and so he became my lawyer for a while, helping me sort things out.
Right.
And that's my first contact with the law in Hong Kong,
right,
from the solicitor's side.
And I think you worked with a character known as Tony Gurkha?
Yes, also during the early stages of my business startup, I was encouraged to take on a role with Tony, which I did on the strict understanding that I could keep running my company and that when my company took off, I wouldn't be with him any longer. But I did a couple of years there in IPR investigations.
So to some extent, that fitted in with your old police days, didn't it? Because you were trying to hunt down people that were selling counterfeit goods.
Well, all crime is crime, right? At the end of the day, it's all about evidence and objects, items, seizures and the law. So I think you could theme it together, yes. I mean, and even the commercial holography we were doing a lot of product security tagging for anti-counterfeiting. So my own company itself was making millions of labels that were being applied to everything from garments to batteries to watches as anti-counterfeiting devices or authentication. So there was a lot of commonality through to it, yeah.
In those early days as a solicitor, you started to specialize, I know, in the hospitality business and in particular the licensing of bars and restaurants. That would be right, I think.
Yeah. Correct, yeah, absolutely. Okay.
That fell into your orbit by accident, or you enjoyed that area of industry, the business of it?
I think it was a total confluence, as all these things are. A set of very lucky iterations, members of your firm who were already advising food and beverage businesses. So there was a link there. And then as those businesses had regulatory or licensing problems, me being an ex-enforcement police officer, Cantonese speaker, and pragmatic business person, I could jump into those areas and help, talk to people basically on all sides. And then unfortunately, the terrible disaster that happened in Lan Kwai Fong, if you remember, there was a tragic New Year's Eve disaster, which cost a lot of lives. That triggered a very rapid response by the authorities to crack down on bars and restaurants that were not licensed. The reality was the licensing system was dysfunctional and very slow. And it was one of those, what's the phrase, honored in the breach? You know, it's sort of a given that because everything was working so badly, you would operate for a while. And either you'd be prosecuted once or twice, but it was more or less an acceptance that it took so long to get a bar open or a restaurant open.
Yeah.
That nobody could afford to remain shut for the duration. After the disaster, that changed. There was no more tolerance.
Was the Lan Kwai Fong disaster, which I do remember, though I think I was out of time at the time, was that caused by some licensing breaches?
As far as I remember, not really, no. It was a side effect of far too many people in a narrow street, a surface that was not capable of good traction, and then a degree of either fluids, liquids, or those spray New Year's celebration streamer things, all conspiring together to result in a slide of people down a hill.
An awful event.
The surface has been changed now. Crowd control is strict, and I think there was even a stage built in the middle. That wouldn't happen again these days.
So,
unfortunate, very tragic, but the side effect of it was a sort of stream of enforcement action which needed to be managed.
Now, as a matter of interest, do you think they've gone too far in that regard now?
In terms of crowd regulation?
No, not that so much, but the sort of regulations that govern restaurants and bars. I mean, I know it's very difficult still to get those licenses through, and that's part of your business.
It's actually a lot easier. Yeah, so back in the late 80s, there was a study commissioned by the government. It was called the Business Services Promotion Unit, I think, and into the inefficiencies of the licensing system. And then I was on that team and managed to innovate, or we recommended, let's put it that way, a number of things. Funnily enough, I was looking at an old report that some of the things still haven't been done, but one that did happen was what was called a provisional licensing system. And that took food licensing and quasi-commercialized it. So it allowed operators to get open without the government inspecting their properties, without a need for government inspections, at least for half a year, on the basis of utilizing a commercialized system.
Could you get liquor licenses temporarily as well?
Yes, you could get a liquor license off the back of that.
I see.
Traditionally, the practice is generally to accept that if you've got a food license or a provisional one, you're safe environmentally, structurally, fire escape-wise, and therefore, all those things being equal, for one half of the consideration, you can have your liquor license. You still need a fit and proper person. It still needs to be in the public interest.
Right.
So there's a three-part test.
So if we broaden this out a little bit, we all know, because we read about it in the press, and in fact you're vocal on social media and LinkedIn, that the industry at the moment, the hospitality industry in Hong Kong, is going through difficult times. It's going through difficult times. So it's not because of licensing, it's not because of COVID, is it? Or is it because of other reasons that the industry is suffering here? It's a big topic, right?
Yeah. All right, taking point number one, you can always have a more streamlined licensing process. I mean, you could have no licenses. You just simply say to people, here are the rules, comply with them. If you don't comply, you'll get prosecuted. That's it. You don't need to have inspections. You don't need to have a regime at all. But the government's always very good at permissions and licenses and certificates and forms and collecting money and the like. Also, in a high-rise community, that kind of reliance on, as long as you're going to be okay, it doesn't matter. Fire, building safety is a problem. So I would say that we could have a more streamlined licensing process. It would make it faster, certainly. I think there are improvements that can be made.
How does it fit in with the region? I mean, Singapore's our big competitor in nearly everything. How do they...
I think it's slightly more predictable in Singapore, what you'll get, certain areas, certain controls. I think because Singapore is perhaps more controlled, it's slightly more predictable, let's put it that way, both in terms of timing and what you're going to get and what you can do. It actually means Hong Kong's more flexible. You actually might get a lot more.
So one of the areas that's always struck me as being underused is the waterfront. Now, on Tsim Sha Tsui side, there are a reasonable number of outlets, a reasonable number along the coast. But on this side, if you walk along that very broad pavement area along the coast up to the convention centre, there's virtually nothing. Why is that?
In Tsim Sha Tsui, there's very little, actually, if you think of it. The only alfresco restaurants are further back when you get into Tsim Sha Tsui East. The actual government waterfront doesn't have a lot.
And if you come to Hong Kong side, it's even more barren.
Next to nothing.
So why? We've got this fabulous coastline.
I think the immediate fix for that wouldn't even require building anything. So The first step, I think, would be to say, right, let's get, this is another old topic, that something that did not work, but should have. Let's get a load of food trucks. That'd be a good start. Those could just drive on because the whole access is drivable for fire and safety. There could be fixed pitch food truck licenses or the like. They could literally be drive on, drive off, wouldn't concern anything. And then each one could be given a small area of seating around it. I think that could be turned on instantly. Mm. You wouldn't need to build anything.
Who's in charge of that? Who would you speak to the government and say, come on, guys, let's get real. We've got this beautiful coastline. We're trying to get out of a bit of a slump.
I think, forget a department, because every department will want to have a say.
I mean,
fire service will want to have escape routes. Buildings department will want to understand what's going on with sanitation. Food and environmental hygiene department will want to ensure food quality and the like. I don't think there's any one department. That's part of the problem. We need somebody in government to be a supremo for the industry. Now, we do have a legislative council member, but that's not the government. That's a voice and only a single voice for the industry. And that voice is diluted across numerous sectors, from Chinese banquet restaurants to karaoke nightclubs. So they're not going to champion.
No.
Why can't we have F&B on the waterfront?
But at the moment, you can't.
I think the government could carve out, say, 20 slots, put them up for tender and set some baseline specifications. They do allow a large amount of food and beverage within things like Cock and Flap, the festival, wine and dine. You'll see the government allowing all these stands selling food, always within one corralled area. However, those are licensed and they're allowed. So there's no reason why you couldn't simply take maybe 15 or 20 of those.
Right.
But you'd need a champion who says, yes, that'd be good for Hong Kong. I'm not so sure the static little huts like they have over in Chimsey on the waterfront are
pretty dull, aren't they?
Yeah, I think you need something a bit more nuanced and fun.
All right. So you've been very involved in the bar industry and the restaurant industry. Can you see, as from where you stand, other areas where Hong Kong could branch out and improve? Because, as I said earlier, Hong Kong Inc. is trying to get back on the map. It's competing with other areas, other places in the region, Singapore particularly, probably. What else could be done to revitalize tourism and local consumption in the city, do you think?
Well, going back one last step, I think, first of all, if we want to have better food and beverage and entertainment landscapes, we need to revise how our buildings are built. That's flowing from design parameters and criteria, rather than allowing people to build faceless offices with facades and to-ceiling glass and nothing else. We need to get away from that and have a better design, which takes account of community needs and our long-term aims. So that's one end of the telescope. At the other end, I think we need to integrate our ideas of how we accommodate tourists, where we put them, where they can stay, with where they can enjoy themselves. We haven't really done that either.
No.
So we take the New Territories, for example. There's a mass of country parks, countryside areas that people could go to, and there's no hotels. There's no way to get there. There's tons of land. There's tons of opportunity to create amazing things. But A, you can't get to them. And B, even if you can, it's a trek. And there's no residential solution. We don't have Airbnb. And yet there's so many resources, bike paths, reservoirs, hikes, mountains. But our tourism industry doesn't even promote it, let alone facilitate it.
So I know that you're very keen on bicycling, aren't you?
Yeah, that's cycling, yeah. It's become a thing after my knees have rebelled from being a runner.
Okay, good. And that's something that could be promoted, perhaps.
Very, very easily. Yeah, I mean, we've got an incredible network of cycle paths. They're not perfectly built because, just like cycle paths elsewhere in the world, I'm not sure that cyclists were involved in their creation, but they're nearly there. But then again, there's nothing along them to provide respite or the like. Mm. It's the same thing in the Thailand Country Park. I think we chatted on that a while back.
Yes.
Why don't we have park wardens? Why don't we have people to facilitate hiking? Why don't we have rest stops with provisions? I mean, if you're going to go into the country parks, you want to be safe. Also, of course, you can't cycle into those paths. So again, you're not allowed to take your bicycle between Thai Tam Reservoir and Parkview.
Mm.
Why not? That's ridiculous. Like, you should be able to cycle there. But for some reason, the government's decided you can't.
Yeah, I suppose you need a cycling lane, otherwise you'd be sort of running over the pedestrians.
No, that's ridiculous. Combination lanes are valid all over the world. Japan has them. I think even in Hong Kong, to some point, we come close to it. So, I know, you can coexist with pedestrians. I mean, cyclists don't have to be herring along flat out all the time. They can take it easy and enjoy the view.
So I'm going to, if I may, switch the topic of Hong Kong a little bit around and go back to 1997 and just before. And I'm going to do this because you and I had lunch recently and we were chatting about the time when Chris Patten, the first governor that was a politician rather than a mandarin, came in to supervise the handover.
And? And then?
So, what I'm interested in discussing with you for a moment is this. I was listening to a podcast recently when, I think it's Lord Patten nowadays, isn't it?
I believe so.
Probably. Anyway, Chris Patten was talking about various things, including Hong Kong. And inevitably, he talked about the whole issue of democracy, which really was his signature tune when he was there. I mean, that's what he used to talk about. And at the end of the podcast, there was a discussion which suggested, it didn't involve Chris Patten at that stage, it was Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart, probably, who were saying that perhaps it would have been wise to have channeled the energies of an energetic man, Chris Patten, and made it more congruent with what was possible to achieve, given the status of Hong Kong relative to mainland China. And I wondered if things would have been very different in the hospitality business, and generally, of course, if the whole issue of democracy had been downplayed rather than upplayed.
Yeah, I don't think post-97 handover we had too much of a problem. Things were not that bad. I mean, obviously, the Asian crisis-type situation that occurred...
2008.
Well, no, the even the sort of more financial issues that occurred in the sort of 98, 99 period.
Yeah.
But F&B still did okay. I think F&B's pretty agnostic. Well, except when the riots were going on, that then it became whether or not you were a yellow or a blue restaurant even. But with that very narrow moment, I think the industry's always been outside of politics.
Yeah.
So I don't think they were necessarily impacted as an industry by political machinations. I certainly don't remember F&B struggling against a backdrop of, oh, the politics of Hong Kong is so difficult at the moment, we can't sell burgers. That doesn't really...
No, in fact, I think it actually was doing pretty well up until 2019.
Yeah, I think when the civil disturbances started, then tourism backs off, the mood changed, people were beginning to wonder what's going to happen next. And then, of course, we got sideswiped by COVID. So,
so we had two tragedies, one on top of the
other.
Well,
the industry was on its knees already.
Yeah. 2019 did a lot of damage to the industry.
Absolutely.
And to other aspects of Hong Kong.
Yeah. It was devastating, actually. People were really, really suffering already.
Yeah.
And so most people went into COVID nursing a lot of damage, lot of economic loss. Some simply folded at that time and pulled out completely and said, that's it. Others soldiered on. But people are still limping along now. They're not back.
It's not a full throttle because we don't have the tourism.
We don't have the tourism. We face regional competition for our own population. Right. So remember that the exodus factor, not the religious one, but the practical one, is these every public holiday, people going all points to Thailand, Japan, whatever.
Shenzhen.
Park that one. I mean, let's just talk about the more long-range holidaying, which is cheaper to do. I did a LinkedIn post ages ago pointing out a traditional Japanese set meal in Hong Kong at a quality restaurant, at a very good one. You're better off jumping on a plane and going to Osaka. It's cheaper for a high-quality meal, including the flights and the hotel.
Yeah.
Now, that's difficult. So, our own pricing has kind of got carried away a little bit. We are very expensive.
Yes, for sure.
For the regional competitors. And then, as you say, there is Shenzhen as well for a different swathe of the market.
Yep.
But the clients that I generally represent are not as impacted by that, to be fair.
No. So, what I had in mind, I suppose, was that having stirred the pot of democracy, we got 2019, and then the fallout from there is still felt because 2019 caused such such damage.
Yeah, but even then, surely if you're talking about stirring the pot of democracy, Chris Patten was doing that. He didn't start it in 2019.
No.
Right, that was way earlier than that.
Yes.
And so there were a lot of other people who have to be called to account. I'm not defending Chris Patten here, but Chris Patten had got on a boat and sailed into the sunset a long time before 2018 and 2019 came to play.
Yeah, yeah.
So that damage, to lay that at the doorstep of Chris Patten might be a little bit of a stretch.
I wasn't really laying it at the door. It was a thought that was provoked, as I say, by a discussion that he was having with two other people on a podcast, and the notion that some of Hong Kong's expectations were raised in a not entirely realistic way.
Well, that for sure, people raised expectations.
Yeah.
And for sure, I actually said, why do you think that Hong Kong's going to become a kind of independent entity, a bit like Singapore or something?
Yeah.
That to me was never a realistic view of our future. Never.
So here we are in Hong Kong today. Between us, let's think about it. We've been around 80 years.
If
you add it together. From your perspective, still your home?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Occasionally people say, when are you going to go home? And the answer is, well, considering I left the UK when I was 18, that is not home for sure. Hong Kong is home. I've grown up here, brought family up here, established businesses, had a professional life here. It's very, very much home. And yourself?
No, for me, it's still home.
Yeah.
Having arrived, both of us, in the 1970s, we can look back on it with some interest and seeing it develop still today and to look forward to the future with some confidence.
Well, there are many areas that haven't changed. I do encourage people to realize that, I mean, if you go up to the New Territories, there are many small villages, there are many communities even, that are still functioning exactly as they were when I arrived in Yuen Long in the 70s. And also operating to the same family values, the same social interaction values. Not a lot has changed, right?
Yeah.
So it depends which bit of Hong Kong you're looking at. Yeah. Some parts haven't really lost what they had back then at all. The city's better. Change for the better, certainly. Communications, transport, you name it. I've often said to people that getting around is just so much easier.
Yeah.
But if you want the heart of Hong Kong or the original bits, it's still there if you bother to go and walk around and find it. It's not lost. I wish we could get some more of it back in Central. I've posted on LinkedIn about the side streets, the little stores. Literally this morning, coming to this podcast, I passed on Peel Street. There was an old fellow who had an old umbrella repair stand, and it's gone. Well, the umbrella repair stand is still there. Undoubtedly, he's left us. We need to get some of that texture back.
Yes.
To the side streets, to the small neighborhoods. Whether or not there's some 20-year-old kid who wants to repair umbrellas or not today. Yes. And is willing to sit in that hut and do it.
That's another thing.
That's another thing. But surely, let's see if we can make it available as a possibility. So I think there's an element of reinvigoration needed as well.
So we remain supportive, we remain optimistic, and perhaps the message is we should get about a bit. See those outlying areas.
I think I'm very supportive of the fact that Hong Kong provides opportunities.
Yeah.
That they are here. We are not heavily regulated. It's very light touch. In Hong Kong, to be fair.
It is.
I mean, I was just working on food delivery services law. There's an 8-page voluntary code of practice. That's it. The legislation simply really says cover the food and you can deliver it. It's not that hard. Other countries, Deliveroo are pulling out, citing over-regulation, right?
Yeah.
We're not heavily regulated in many areas. You can get a business up and running in a flash. There's a lot of opportunity. So yes, I'm optimistic that there are chances and opportunities. Getting space is difficult. You know, land is tight, it's expensive, but technology now provides us with opportunities as well. So yeah, for that, I think get out a bit more. Yes, everybody who lives on Hong Kong Island should get out to the New Territories, get out into the villages, walk.
And be you male or female, walking around the streets at midnight, safe.
Oh, undoubtedly, that's one of Hong Kong's major pluses. It's safe. I don't worry about having my phone snatched out of my hand when I'm walking through the business district. I couldn't imagine what that would be like. So yeah, that definitely safe. I think Hong Kong's pretty flat in terms of race, opportunities for whoever you are. I don't think there's any massive biases existing. It's been a pretty business-focused, opportunity-focused economy, so I see that. So it's home. I mean, I'm not boosting it beyond the achievable. Like all places, there are hurdles. Government officials, government departments can be difficult. But with the right lobbying, the right politeness, the right effort, and getting the right person, you can achieve a lot here. A lot of clients have had initial no or cannot, and we've converted it into successes. Really good ones.
Well, there's your talent. Adrian, thank you very much for joining us today. On that note, I'm going to go for a walk about in the country parks.
All right. Well, I'll join you maybe one day. Cheers.
Thank you very much.